Boys and girls, your attention, please. Presenting a new exciting radio program featuring the thrilling adventures of an amazing and incredible personality.
This is Alec Baldwin. There are lots of ways to show you have style. Wearing fur isn't one of them. Each year, millions of animals are drowned or beaten to death in the wild, or gassed or electrocuted in captivity for their coats. Cruelty is one fashion statement we can do without. Please help the animals by joining People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
To find out how you can help, visit furisdead.com or call 757-622-PETA.
Transmission will start in 5 seconds from now. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, in.
Hello, my friends. It is March 3rd, 2021. You are listening to Time Travel with Chris Earle on WMFO in Medford, Massachusetts. Today we are going to do story time. Story time is a bunch of stories. We have a couple of radio plays in here. I'm going to read you a story myself. And I got my little nephew, Nicholas. He's going to do his radio debut today. He pre-recorded a little clip for you of Calvin not being able to fly. It's called Calvin Can't Fly. It's about a little starling bird, and we're going to hear that. We also have Jean-Luc Picard, Patrick Stewart himself, with Peter and the Wolf. We will be doing that. We also have myself. I'm going to be reading you a story I wrote quite a while ago now. It's a story called Dick. It's about my fish and about setting up my aquarium back in the year 2000, so a little over 20 years ago. I used to be a big aquafatic. Is that it? Aquafatic? I was an aquaritarian. That's what it is. It's an aquatarian. Aquaritarian. I used to be aquaritarian, and then I grew up. I'll read you that story, and I'll have one called The Black Door from a radio show called Suspense that we're going to start off the only 2 hours. It's the next 2 hours. It's time travel. It's story time here on WMFO. My name is Chris Earle. Thank you for listening to Freeform Radio. It has been a year since the coronavirus, and it's been a year since I've been doing this show remotely, and hopefully we have things lined up for the year, and things will be back open again soon. I know a few things are opening here this week in Massachusetts. I'm set to get my shot this week. I'll let you know how that goes. If you don't hear from me, it was bad. It was bad. Otherwise, next week I will be back for year 13. I'm celebrating 13 years. I started on March 11th, 2008. Was the official start date of time travel. I was on a number of radio programs before that as a guest and just substituting, but then I finally launched my show 13 years ago on March 11th, 2008. So I'm going to do a clip show next week, and I'm going to play like the best of time travel, some of my favorite songs from over the years, and a bunch of clips from some guests that we had on back before COVID was real. We used to have guests in the studio, so a number of my friends that were musicians or comics or family members, or just random people off the street. We used to even do that. Anyway, that's next week. Enjoy story time today. Here's your first story.
And now, a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense. Listen now to Act One of The Black Door, starring Robert Reddick, featuring Ralph Camargo, and written especially for Suspense by Robert Arthur.
The mistake I made was going through that black door. If I'd left it shut the way it was, sealed tight, everything would have been fine. I'd have married Marcia, become a full professor, had my name in all the papers. Well, there's no use telling the story backwards, is there? First things first, as old Professor Wentworth always said. And the first thing in this case is the grant I received to hunt for a lost city in Central America. The city of the fire god. Which might mean something, or might mean nothing. Anyway, I got the grant from the university, chartered a modern helicopter for 3 months, flew it down to Central America, got the necessary government permissions, and made my base of operations the tiny little town of San Marcos on the coast. As nearly as I could figure from the manuscript, the city of the fire god was someplace among the mountains in that area. So I flew back and forth over the mountains in the helicopter, keeping a lookout for ruins in the jungle or the mountain valleys. And for 2.5 months, I saw nothing except trees and rocks. In the town, I was charitably looked upon as a crazy Yankee. And finally, even the children stopped staring at me. But I was getting pretty discouraged. And trying to forget my troubles with a glass of tequila in a little garden outside the town's only cafe, while some native with a guitar serenaded his girl nearby.
Waiter?
Wait.
Oh, there you are.
Pardon, senor. I am not the waiter. He's busy.
Busy? No one's been busy in this town since Columbus discovered America.
That's very true, senor, but I have paid the waiter to go somewhere else. That's why he's busy. look at this, senor.
Well, let me see that. That's a tiny statue, very old.
Huh?
Statue carved out of volcanic basalt in the style of the oldest known Mayan carving. Where did you get that?
Oh, that is easily answered, senor.
Well, then tell me.
My grandfather, he gave it to me when he died.
Well, where did he get it?
Senor, that is a harder question.
Now, look, if you came here just to play games with
No, senor. That is why I sent away the waiter. So we could talk confidentially.
Yes, well, let's talk confidentially. Where did that little statue come from?
From the mountains, senor.
But the whole country is mountains.
Si, that is true, but... you see, my grandfather was a great hunter. Once he followed a wounded jaguar high into the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
Some savage natives then followed my grandfather.
Yes?
When he was wounded, and to escape, he climbed a great cliff.
Go on.
And he reached the top, and on the other side... he saw a dead city.
A dead city?
Si, senor. Silent. Lifeless. Far below him.
Yes?
He tried to climb down to it. And he fell, senor. For 3 days he lay unconscious. And when he recovered his senses, he had the fever.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow he found his way out. He does not know how. He staggered back to his home.
Yes.
They found him in the jungle, crawling on his hands and knees, clutching this little statue and saying over and over, La Puerta Negra! La Puerta Negra!
The what?
The black door, senor.
The black door?
Si, senor. And my poor grandfather, he was never strong enough to go hunting again, but he kept this little statue. And he said it had saved his life.
What did he mean by the black door?
Oh, one cannot say, senor. He could not remember.
Surely he went back to the lost city?
Well, he was not strong enough. Besides... there were the savages.
But you mean nobody ever tried to find the city again?
Well, why should they, senor? It belonged to the dead. Or they might be angry if the living came to disturb them,
eh? Those old superstitions.
Si, senor. Now, me, I am not superstitious, eh? I speak American well. The senor wishes to find this lost city. I, Pedro Ramirez, know where it is.
Go on.
You see, my grandfather described it to me. The mountains where it is hidden.
Yes.
They are 3 days walk from here.
No, 3 days. Now, that's 50 or 60 miles. What direction?
Senor, that is the question, eh? What direction? Most important question, no?
I get it. How much?
A mere pittance for a rich Yankee, senor. $1,000 American.
$1,000?
And one half of all the treasure.
What treasure is that?
Oh, there must be treasure, senor. Why else would you seek this lost city?
Because I want to become a professor at a university and marry a girl named Marcia, whose father is head of the Department of Archaeology. All right. $1,000 if you actually guide me to the city you say your grandfather found.
And half the treasure?
Yes. Half the treasure. If any. We sealed the bargain with a glass of tequila. And the next day, Pedro came with me in the helicopter. He directed me to fly to the southeast, and I did, hovering as low as I dared over the rocky edges and jungle.
Well, we've come more than 50 miles, Pedro. No sign of that city yet.
Oh, yes, senor. There to the left. There is the mountain.
What, that? Now, you're crazy. That's the cone of an extinct volcano.
Si, senor. And the lost city is inside the volcano.
Oh, now, wait a minute. How could that be?
Well, I do not know. I was not there when it was built.
On the other hand, city of the fire god. I wonder. Well, I haven't looked into that volcano yet, so here goes.
We lifted high in the air over the top of the old dead volcano. And we came out over a deep circular valley grown up with jungle now. But there, in the center of the jungle, was a group of stone buildings dominated by a vast ruined temple.
Señor! Señor! The lost city of my grandfather. Oh, it is rich with treasure. I have the feeling.
Well, even if it isn't, this is one of the biggest finds in the history of Central America. We're going down now. We'll sit down on that level spot right in front of the temple.
We settled in front of the old temple. I cut the motors. And for a moment, we just sat there taking it in. The stone towers. The ancient carvings. The massive walls that had been put into place by men whose bones had turned to dust maybe 3,000-4,000 years ago. And then we climbed out. We were both armed. We had flashlights. And I had a small hammer and chisel tucked into my belt. Aboard the helicopter, I had a case of dynamite if any blasting was necessary, but this was just to be a preliminary survey, so I left it where it was. Pedro and I found ourselves on a big stone plaza with the partially ruined temple in front of us. The entrance was flanked by two tremendous stone carvings. Oddly enough, very like something from Egypt. Human figures with heads that were vaguely dog-like, which made them seem most unhuman.
Senor, those statues, I do not like them.
Yes, they are rather odd. But I'm more interested in those designs carved in the rock above them.
Eh? Designs, senor? Oh, they but show the moon, the new moon and the old moon.
Yes, and there are more moons all over the front of the temple. Now, that's unusual. Most of the old civilizations in this area worship the sun.
Si, senor, but I cannot help wondering.
Wondering what?
Why the man who made those statues put the heads of dogs on them.
It was dark inside the temple, but our flashlights gave us enough light. Vast stone pillars supported a roof high above us as we moved down along a lengthy corridor. And then we came into a central rotunda. I got some sunlight through a crack in the roof.
Look! Look, senor! Gold! Gold! 10 statues! 12 statues! And each of them solid gold! Come, look, senor! Gold! Gold! I have reached!
Pedro was right. Ranged in a circle in the middle of the rotunda were 12 golden statues about 5 feet high. They were all human figures with dog-like heads. And they were all looking at a spot on the floor in the middle of the circle they made.
Gold, senor! And look, jewels! Jewels! Baskets of them! Oh, senor! Senor, I am the richest man in the world!
At the foot of each statue, a carved stone basket. And each one has a handful of gems in it. Obviously, these statues were worshipped, and the gems were tribute. Pedro, have you taken a good look at these statues? Shine your light on this one.
Madre mia! Again, the head of the dog!
Yes, they're all dog-headed statues. And all their eyes are focused on one spot over there. It seems to be something carved on the floor. Let's see what that is.
Senor. That is more strange.
A round black carving on the floor. Almost like a globe or a map.
Good Lord.
Do you know what this is supposed to be?
No, senor, I cannot guess.
It's the moon. Carved on the floor in black basalt, the moon.
Ah, see. Oh, that is most strange,
yes,
no?
Yes, you don't know the half of it, because the formations carved here, they're not the formations our astronomers know, unless the Russians have some new pictures they're not talking about. If this carving represents the real geography of the moon... Pedro?
Si, senor?
The artist who carved this must at some time have seen the dark side of the moon, which no human being has ever glimpsed. I know it sounds crazy, but the more I studied that round black carving, the more I was convinced it was an accurate relief map of the dark side of the moon. And then we discovered something else. Around the rim of that black disk was a series of crevices filled with tar. I dug the tar out, and under it, in each crevice, we found a small basalt statuette like the one that Pedro had originally shown me. In each crevice but one, which was empty.
Senor, see? The story of my grandfather is true. This little statue he brought back, look. It just fits into this tiny hole.
Yes, yes, it does. The black door. This must be the black door that he talked about.
Ah, sí, señor. La puerta negra. The black door. But how does it open?
I don't know. Now, wait, wait. Suppose we stand each of these little statues upright.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, they fit tightly like handles. Now, if we push them...
Si, senor, we push.
And it's turning.
I see.
The black disc is turning. And now it's loose. Now we can lift it up.
Let us lift it. Down there, maybe more treasure, eh? More gold, more jewels.
All right. Now it's coming.
See?
There, it's open. And there's a well-worn flight of steps leading down into the heart of the old volcano. We stood there, staring down to that black passageway that seemed to go down, down endlessly. I didn't like the looks of it. But Pedro had gold fever. He thought that there might be whole vaults of treasure down below. I couldn't talk him out of looking, so I went along too. The tunnel sloped downward, ever downward into the heart of the ancient volcano. We came across evidence of much usage, broken pottery, strange carvings on the wall. Our curiosity led us on until presently we came to a cavern whose walls seemed to be lined by a curious growth.
Senor, look!
Yes, yes, mushrooms or something very much like mushrooms, solid sheets of it all lining the walls.
No, senor, that is not what I mean. Look here. Look through here.
Oh, a narrow crevice. There's a room in there.
That's not a room. It is what is in the room. Come, shine your light. Then let us leave, senor.
What has got you so worked up? It can't be treasure. I see.
See? A skeleton, senor. Many skeletons. Hundreds, many. Lying one upon the other.
Yes, yes. That rocky room is full of human bones. And much as I hate to say it...
What, senor?
The ones I can see best have tooth marks on them.
Oh, senor, let us leave here swiftly. Let us return to the airplane, eh? Let us take the treasure and go.
Easy now, Pedro. These bones have been here hundreds of years, maybe thousands.
Old bones or new bones, I do not like these bones.
There's no cause for alarm. I don't know.
Why does the senor study so hard the mushrooms on the wall?
Well, these mushrooms certainly haven't been here for 1,000 years, and along here it looks to me as if big handfuls of them have been broken off.
Broken off? For why?
There's only one thing I know of you can do with mushrooms, and that's eat them. Pedro and I stood staring at each other. I was pretty sure that something, or somebody, had recently been eating that mushroom-like fungus. And I was beginning to wonder what, or who, when we heard it from somewhere far down below us.
Senor, what is that?
It sounded like a dog howling.
A dog? No. That is no dog.
Well, what if it's not a dog? What is it?
A demon, senor. A devil.
Oh, forget that superstition. There's something down there, impossible as it seems, something living.
And if we do not leave, there will be something dying down here, senor. Please, come.
Yes, but I'm trying to figure out what on earth that could...
Senor Landrish... Those are not dogs upstairs. The statues, the people with heads of dogs upon them. Does the senor not realize what it is that is howling?
Until that second, I hadn't made the connection. And then I realized the full significance of those statues. It couldn't be. It was impossible. But what other answer was there? We turned to head for the surface, and just as we did so, I saw something coming up the tunnel toward us. Something that was a pallid white shape in the light of my flashlight. Something running on all fours and howling hungrily as it did so.
Shoot, senor, shoot!
Okay, that stopped it. Now, let's get out of here. We didn't even stop to look at what I'd shot. I'm not sure I wanted to look. We just turned and ran up that long tunnel to the surface. And as we went, the howling things pursued us. We could hear them behind us like a pack of hungry animals. From time to time, I turned to fire my gun. But I seemed to scare them. We finally popped out into that ruined temple with the 12 dog-headed gods. And I understood at last what that black door was for. It sealed the entrance to the underground world where they lived. Pedro and I flung ourselves on the ground. A great round slab of black rock was, and we couldn't move it. It was wedged open somehow, and we couldn't get it closed.
Senor! Senor, quickly! They will follow us in a moment!
Gathered down there beyond the first bend. Obviously, they don't like light.
They are getting up their courage.
Now we've got to shut them in. We can't let those things loose. But we can't shut the black door.
We can do nothing. The helicopter, quickly.
I got it. The dynamite in the helicopter. We'll blow in the mouth of the tunnel.
But, senor...
You heard me. It'll only take 60 seconds. Yeah, that'll keep them quiet another minute or two. Now, come on, help me with that case of dynamite. It took us less than a minute to get the case of dynamite, bring it back inside the temple and light a fuse. And then I shoved the whole case down the steps into the black tunnel. Pedro and I hurried back into the open, scrambled into the helicopter, and started the motor just in case.
Ah, Senor Landry.
What is it?
The treasure. The jewels. We did not bring them.
We can get them after the tunnel is blown in. You don't want to tangle with those dog-headed creatures, do you?
No, por los santos, no. But, Senor, what are they? They must be demons, for surely they are not of this world.
Well, I agree with you, but they're not demons. Listen. That does it. Tunnel is closed for good. Now, Pedro...
Senor, the temple is collapsing. And the earth is shaking. Senor, it's an earthquake.
Pedro, there's only one place for us to go, and that's straight up. The helicopter jumped 1,000 feet straight up, just before the temple crashed on the spot where we had been. And then we watched from a box seat, while the lost city crumbled into ruins. The dynamite blast had triggered off an earthquake, and the earthquake rocked the ground like a man shaking a baby's rattle.
Senor, senor, the jewels, the gold, they are down there under many rocks.
Yes, and so are the dog-headed creatures. Suppose they'd got loose on the world after being caged underground for thousands of years.
Oh, I can only think of all that treasure. For a little while, I was the richest man in the world. I owned a lost city full of jewels. Now I own nothing.
After things quiet down, I can bring back an expedition. We'll dig in the ruins. The jewels will still be there.
You see... See, that is true, no? I will be rich yet, no? I will buy myself 3 automobiles and 12 silk shirts. I will smoke cigars all day long and have servants to do everything. Senor, I am ruined.
What is it now?
The dead volcano. He's coming to life. See, the smoke is coming from the ground. Senor, fly higher or we are doomed.
Well, that tied it. The dynamite triggered an earthquake, and the earthquake opened up fissures leading far down to where the volcanic fires had been banked for thousands of years. And by the time we got 10 miles away, that entire mountain was blowing up in a vast spouting fire and ashes and molten rock. But somewhere down in the heart of that inferno was the lost city. The city of the fire god. It would have made my reputation. Enough treasure to pay off the national debt. And a howling mob of creatures you wouldn't want to meet this side of hell. Well, that's the story. You read about the new volcano. And now you know what caused it. Would you like to know my theory about those creatures? Well, it's this. 6 or 7,000 years ago, this old earth had some visitors, refugees, you might call them. Some of them settled in Egypt, some in Central America. They brought some highly scientific skills with them, including the secret of overcoming gravity. They ruled for a while, worshipped as gods, and then died out. All except a few who found inside an old volcano a spot just about like home. The native priests managed to lock them in behind that black door and kept them prisoners. After the natives died out, the dog people existed underground, living on mushrooms and keeping their race alive on an animal level. Now they're gone now. But here's a tip for the Army and the Air Force. When you land your first missiles on the moon, keep your eyes open and your guns ready. Because inside those tremendous craters of the moon, living far underground where, maybe, there's still warmth and air, I have a hunch you're going to be running into people. Moon people. Who look a lot like us. Except for their heads.
Suspense. You've been listening to The Black Door, starring Robert Reddick, featuring Ralph Camargo, and written especially for Suspense by Robert Arthur. Suspense is produced and directed by Bruno Zerato Jr. Music supervision by Ethel Huber. Listen again next week when we return with Man Trap, written by John Roberts. Another tale well calculated to keep you in suspense. Listen to Carol Burnett and Richard Hayes weeknights on the CBS Radio Network.
It ended almost 60 years ago now. It ended in 1962. It was Suspense, a radio drama on CBS Radio. It started in 1940 and went to 1962. And you had all these great actors over the years. A lot of them started in radio, and they moved on to film and television. Of course, at the end there, you can hear about Carol Burnett, but you also had a number of other great, great stars in there. They did 946 episodes, and they said that another 900 were actually recorded, and they never used them. So there's a treasure trove of Suspense there in the CBS vault somewhere, and I guess they tried to revamp it on Sirius Radio. They played some of this a number of years ago on Sirius Radio. You never know, it may come back again. I find that fascinating. I think that 1961 one that I just found there, The Black Door, I think it's just a great story and a lot of fun. You know, you have the know-it-all, you know, adventurer with his sidekick and just a cool story, you know. That'd keep me at my radio if I was a kid. Kept me on the radio now. Kept me in front of my iTunes for a few minutes listening to that. So, like I said, it's a story time's about. Kick back and listen to a story and relax and take it easy. This next one's going to be pretty fun. This is my little nephew, Nicholas, and he's 5. He's been learning how to read, and he started reading a bunch of stories. And this was one of the harder ones, but he loves this one, and I love it too, and I think he did a great job, and I'm proud of him as his Uncle Chris. This is Calvin Can't Fly by my little nephew, Nicholas. I shouldn't call him little. He's a big boy. My big boy nephew, Nicholas, and we're all proud of him. He's out in Chicago. All right, I love you. Here's your story.
Calvin Can't Fly, The Story of a Bookworm Birdie by Jennifer Byrne, illustrated by Keith Bendis. Calvin is a starling. He was born under the eaves of a old barn with his 3 brothers, 4 sisters, and 67,432 cousins. Starlings have big families. Right from the beginning, Calvin was different. Right from the day all the little starlings tumble out of their nest to discover the world. Charlie discovered worms. Adeline discovered grass. Clemens discovered dirt. Aubrey discovered water. And Calvin, well, Calvin discovered a book. Well, all of Calvin's cousins chased beetles, bugs, and ants, Calvin was learning to read letters, words, and sentences. At night, his cousins dreamed of insect eating and garbage picking. Calvin dreamed of adventures, story, legends, and poetry. He even dreamed that someday he'd become a great writer himself. On June 1st, when all the little starlings lined up for flying lessons with their teacher, Mr. Wingstead, Calvin was nowhere to be seen. Where's that bird? Actually, Calvin was in the library. As the other little starlings were learning to swoop and hover and fly figure eights, Calvin buried his beak in books, and there his mind soared. Calvin read about pirates and cavemen, volcanoes and rainbows. Whales and dinosaurs. Calvin especially loved dinosaurs. He learned how the planets circle the sun, what makes the wind blow, and amazing facts like how caterpillars grow up to become butterflies. His books took him to places wings never could, and his heart fluttered with excitement. Calvin's cousins called him Nerdy Birdie, Geeky Beaky, and Bookworm. And when you are a bird, being called a worm is a very bad thing. Calvin ruffled his feathers and mumbled, "Oh, how the wounding words of scorn do sting." Then he sadly waddled back to the library, the only place where he was happy. And so he spent all summer reading, learning, and absorbing everything his little starling mind could. Until the first leaf turned orange and fell to the ground. The fall winds sent a chill through the old barn. Summer's nests blew to the floorboards. It was time to head south. His cousins warned, "Calvin, you better learn to fly. In a couple of days, we've gotta be out of here." Calvin said, "Ah, yes, migration. I've read about that." His sister asked, "Calvin, can you fly?" Calvin had to admit he couldn't. all the other starlings took off in a giant formation, but Calvin could only stand and watch. A big lonely tear rolled down his cheek. Calvin turned and trudged back toward the old barn. He was so upset he did not even notice his brothers and sisters and cousins coming back to get him. All of a sudden, they were tying up Calvin's mill with string and scraps of cloth they had found in the garbage. They grasped the other ends with their beaks, and off they flew. With Calvin somewhat embarrassed, safely in tow. For days and days they flew. Calvin recognized the rivers, mountains, and towns he had read about all summer. Excitedly, he pointed them out to his brothers, sisters, and cousins. But the other little starlings just flapped their wings and headed south. Soon there came a day when the winds blew especially hard. Trees bent sideways, leaves scattered wildly. Flying became harder and harder. The air had an odd smell to it, the smell of danger. Calvin, remembering back to his favorite weather book, warned the rest of his family, a hurricane is coming. All his brothers and sisters and cousins asked, what's a hurricane? Calvin explained as quickly as his little beak could, we need to get out of a path of a violent tropical weather system, which is storming up the coast at a tremendous speed and will not diminish until it encounters large stretches of land mass. Everybody make haste into that cave. They had no idea what Calvin was saying. But they had to admit, it did sound real. So the flock made a loop-de-loop left, a dipsy-doodle right, and dove into the cave. They did everything Calvin told them to. Amazement, a great storm did blow across the land. It thundered over the mountains. It roared through the villages. It smashed and crashed, rumbled and raged, just as Calvin had predicted. The whole big starling family gathered together, watching in fear and awe. The storm finally ended. The sun came out in the sky, and the starlings came out of the cave. They were safe and sound, all because of Calvin. they celebrated with a great starling party in honor of Calvin. They ate big, juicy worms and yummy, crunchy beetles. They danced and sang songs about how Calvin had saved their lives. They toasted Calvin with acorn caps filled with fresh, clear mountain water. Calvin was so happy and felt so good deep down inside that he jumped and hopped and danced and flapped his wings. And flapped his wings and flapped his wings. All the other starlings looked at him in amazement. "Calvin, you can fly," they exclaimed. And Calvin, the happiest starling in the whole wide world, chirped, "Why, yes, I do believe I can." And they all flew south with big, wide smiles on their little starling faces, especially Calvin.
Isn't that great? He's handsome, he's smart, he's fun, he's everything that you could want in a little boy. That's my little nephew, Nicholas. My big boy nephew, Nicholas. Good job, Nick. He likes to be called Nick, too. I should be calling him Nick. Or Nico. A lot of times we just say, "Hey, you. Hey, you, come here." Anyway, next one, we're going to do some Superman. We were talking about superheroes and superhero theme songs this week. So I'm going to play this for Nicholas. This is the theme to Superman. Story time here with you until 7 p.m. My name is Chris Earle. Thanks for listening to Freeform Station, WMFO in Medford. We'll be right back.
faster than an airplane, more powerful than a locomotive, impervious to bullets.
Up in the sky, look, it's a bird,
it's a plane, it's Superman! And now, Superman, a being no larger than an ordinary man, but possessed of powers and abilities never before realized on Earth. Able to leap into the air an eighth of a mile at a single bound, hurdle a 20-story building with ease, race a high-powered bullet to its target, lift tremendous weights and rend solid steel in his bare hands as though it were paper. Superman, a strange visitor from a distant planet, champion of the oppressed, physical marvel extraordinary, who has sworn to devote his existence on Earth to helping those in need. As our story begins, we ask you to come with us on a far journey, a journey that takes us millions of miles from the Earth, where the planet Krypton burns like a green star in the endless heavens.
Kellogg's Pep, the super delicious cereal, presents
The Adventures of Superman.
Faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's Superman.
Yes, it's Superman. And today we begin a brand new adventure for the Man of Steel. An adventure that is to test all his great and unusual powers to the utmost. A strange and dramatic scene is taking place in the private office of Editor Perry White at the Daily Planet. Clark Kent, his face ashen gray and his hands clutching the arms of his chair, is staring at the late afternoon edition of the paper on White's desk. The editor, alarmed, has risen and is about to go to Kent's assistance when the door opens and Lois Lane enters.
Clark, I want to ask you if you'd... Good heavens, what's the matter?
Get some water, Lois.
No. I'm all right.
What happened?
Don't stand there asking questions. Get some water.
Well, I hear you. You don't have to scream at me.
Please, Chief, I'm okay.
Meanie.
Now, Kent, you be quiet. Don't try to talk yet.
Chief.
I don't know. We were sitting here talking when...
I'm all right now. There's nothing the matter with me.
There certainly is something the matter with you. You're as pale as a ghost.
I don't want anyone in here.
It's Beanie with the water.
Here you are, Miss Wayne.
Here, Clark. Drink this.
I'm really all right now.
Well, drink it anyway. Water never hurt anyone.
Here, go ahead. Yeah. Don't get up. I'll take the glass.
Oh, I'm all right.
Leave it on the desk.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, can't you just sit back and relax? Now, do as I say.
All right. Sorry I caused all this trouble.
Will someone please tell me what happened?
Well, it was nothing, Lois, really.
It must have been something, because when I walked in here, your face was the color of the chief's hair.
Oh, what's the matter with the color of my hair?
Nothing the matter with it, but it's gray.
When you're as old as I am, yours will be gray, too.
I don't doubt that for a moment. Now, what happened? You started to tell me, Chief.
Well, it was nothing, Lois, believe me.
You keep quiet. Go ahead, Chief.
Oh, thanks.
Good grief. Isn't it possible to carry on a normal conversation around here without sarcasm or screaming or jumping down people's throats? I'm asking a simple question. What happened in here that made Clark look like a ghost?
If you'd only stop talking long enough for another person to get a word in edgewise, maybe you'd find out.
But there's nothing to find out.
You keep out of this.
I'm waiting, Mr. White.
You too.
Me too what?
You too. Never mind. I'd better tell you what happened before you drive me crazy. Now, we were sitting here talking. I don't remember what about. That's unimportant. When someone came up from the press room with a copy of the early afternoon edition of the paper.
Who?
What's the difference? Who? Well, a guy from the press room, a guy named Joe.
All right. Golly.
He put the paper on my desk. Here it is. We went right on talk. I got a phone call, and while I was on the wire, Kent leaned over and glanced at the front page of the paper. Next thing I knew, he looked like he was going to die right in that chair.
Now, wait a minute. That's a slight exaggeration, Chief.
You certainly looked that way when I came in.
Well, maybe I'm tired. Maybe I need a vacation. Right now, I got some work to do in my office.
You come back here and sit down.
Let him go, Chief.
See you all later.
Darn fool. Lois, I'm worried about him. Maybe he
Wait
does need...
Wait a minute now. Let's see what's on the front page of the paper that might have shocked him.
I can't imagine any news story having that effect on him.
MacArthur warns Japs against sabotage. President asks for tax reduction. Coal strike pending. Noted meteorologist dies. 5 rescued from fire. That's all, except for the weather report.
Maybe it wasn't anything in the paper.
Clark has been acting strange lately, Chief. As though he were hiding something.
What's he got to hide?
It might be anything. You know as well as I do, Chief, that Clark isn't really a normal person. There's something peculiar about him.
What do you mean, peculiar?
Well, it's hard to put into words, but ever since I've known Clark, I've had the feeling that that he's leading a double life, that he's keeping something undercover.
Ah, you and your double life.
Well, I have.
Ever since that trial, you've had double life on the brain. He's as honest as the day is long.
Oh, he's honest enough. Good heavens.
Now what?
I think I know what shocked him.
Something on the front page of the paper?
Yes, this item right here. Noted meteorologist dies. Dr. John Whistler, head of the Department of Meteorology at the Metropolis Museum, died at the city hospital this morning following a brief illness.
I know, but why should that upset him so?
Now, listen, you remember about a year ago a strange meteor fell in a field outside the city?
Faintly, yes.
Well, Clark covered that story. The meteor was turned over to this Dr. Whistler, and Clark interviewed him at the museum. I remember now that there was something peculiar about the meteor. The details are a little hazy now, but...
Well, let's call Ken in and ask him about it.
No, wait a minute. Let me think. Let's see. Kryptonite. That's what it was.
What are you talking
about? The meteor. Dr. Whistler called it kryptonite. It was a piece of the planet Krypton.
Stop giving me double talk. What's all this got to do with Kent keeling over?
I don't know, but there must be some connection.
Well, I'll get him in here.
Yes, Mr. White.
Oh, Miss Bacharach, tell Clark Kent I want to see him.
He's gone for the day, Mr. White.
Where'd he go?
I think he said he was going home.
All right. Now, what do you make of that? First he says he's got work to do, and then he goes home.
If you want the truth, I'm worried. I think I'll stop off at his apartment and have a talk with him.
Yeah, well, I'll go along with you.
Good. Shall we leave now?
Well, we might as well.
I'll get my hat and coat, and I'll meet you at the elevator, Chief.
Concerned and puzzled about Clark Kent's condition, Lois and Perry White decide to visit him at his apartment. What will they learn? We'll return in a moment to find out. But first...
Say, here's more of that exciting news. It's about the swell offer Kellogg's Pep has for you. Kellogg's Pep has a smart-looking, streamlined, real sundial wristwatch for you. One that you can wear on your wrist wherever you are to tell you the hour of the day by the sun. And in a minute, I'm going to tell you how you can get it. It's the modern 1945 version of an instrument that's been part of man's life since the days of ancient Egypt. It's about the size of the usual wristwatch, and it's made from gleaming aluminum with a strap that holds it flat on your wrist. To use it, you lift the pointer and aim it due north. The sun's rays will make the shadow of the pointer fall on the dial, showing the hour of the day. Boy, what fun you can have playing cops and robbers and meeting when the shadow falls at 3. Now, here's how you get this grand Kellogg's Pep offer. Ask Mom to get a good supply of Kellogg's Pep at the store. Then send 2 box tops marked top from the Pep packages along with 10 cents in cash and your name and address clearly printed to Superman, Box 157, Battle Creek, Michigan.
And now, back to the adventures of Superman. Alone in his apartment, Clark Kent, obviously troubled, is pacing back and forth across the living room floor. At intervals, he stops short and stands with shoulders hunched, lost for a moment in deep thought. And through it all, another voice, the voice of his conscience, perhaps, keeps talking to him.
You've got to do something about it. You've got to.
What can I do?
That piece of kryptonite. You remember what effect it had on you?
Yes, yes, of course I remember. Robbed me of all my strength. It made me weak.
That's right. And what good is Superman without strength? That kryptonite must be destroyed.
But how can I get near enough to it to destroy it? I told you, it robs me of all my strength.
You've got to get someone to help you. Where is it?
It's in Dr. Whistler's private vault at the museum. He sealed it up at my request. But now he's dead. They'll open that vault, and they won't know the power of that piece of kryptonite. They won't know that it makes Superman a weakling.
Why do you speak of Superman as though he were someone else? It's you we're talking about. You are Superman. It will make you a weakling.
Well, must you remind me of it? Why do you think I almost keeled over in Perry White's office? I knew the danger the moment I saw that item in the paper that Dr. Whistler had died.
Maybe they won't open the vault. Has that ever occurred to you?
Yes, but it's not likely. I'm in constant danger unless that piece of kryptonite is destroyed. Why, I have enemies all over the world. Clever enemies. What if it fell into their hands?
There's only one answer. You'll have to tell someone. You'll have to get someone to help you.
But how can I reveal my identity? That's a secret I've guarded for years. What's that?
Someone's at the door.
Good Lord. Lois and Perry White.
This is your chance. Tell them the story. Get them to help you.
Oh, no. No, I can't.
Just a moment. I'm coming. Oh, well, hello.
What brings you two here?
We just thought we'd stop by to see how you were. May we come in?
Oh, well, sure, of course. Oh, I'm fine now. Feel like $1,000,000.
Now, look, Kent, let's not beat around the bush. There's something wrong with you. You're not yourself.
What do you mean, Chief?
Lois has the idea you're hiding something.
Hiding something?
Clark, do you know anything about a piece of kryptonite?
What? Hey,
Kent, what's the matter?
Nothing.
You see, I was right, Chief. There is a connection.
What are you talking about, Lois?
Now, we want the truth, Kent, straight from the shoulder. You're in trouble, and we know it. We're ready to help you if you'll tell us what's wrong.
But believe me, that...
Clark, be sensible. When you read about Dr. Whistler's death in the chief's office, you almost fainted.
No, you're
just... The same thing happened just a moment ago when I mentioned the piece of kryptonite.
Well,
there must be some connection.
All right. There is some connection.
Well, sit down, Kent, and tell us all about it. Remember that we're your friends. We'll move heaven and earth to help you if we can.
Well, it's a long story, and part of it's going to amaze you, but I suppose I'll have to tell it.
Go ahead, Clark.
Anxiously, Lois Lane and Perry White lean forward in their chairs as Clark Kent draws a deep breath and begins his story. What is he going to tell them? Is he finally, after years of guarding the secret, going to reveal his double identity? Reveal that Clark Kent and Superman are one and the same person? This is a tense moment, a moment for which many of us have been waiting. So be sure to tune in tomorrow, same time, same station, for The Adventures of Superman.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's Superman.
Fellas and girls, be sure to follow The Adventures of Superman. Brought to you every day, Monday through Friday. Same time, same station. By the makers of that super delicious cereal, Kellogg's Pep. And for other thrilling adventures of Superman, see your local newspaper. Superman is also a copyrighted feature appearing in Superman DC Publications. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System. Thank you.